Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief. We begin tonight with a Law and Crime exclusive, which involves the collision of law and politics in the upcoming civil trial filed by billionaire Jeffrey Epstein. The financier is accused of sexually abusing more than 40 underage girls. Law and Crime has confirmed that both former President Bill Clinton and current President Donald Trump will be mentioned in the case. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross joins us tonight to explain the connections. Brian, good evening.
Good evening, Aaron. It's a strange case. Epstein, who pleaded guilty to two counts of prostitution and received what many regard as a very light sentence of 18 months, has now sued the lawyer representing some of those underage girls, claiming malicious prosecution and defamation. He hardly seems to be the kind of person who would assume that he'd have his reputation damaged any more than it has been. But in part of it is two prominent people who were friends with Jeffrey Epstein, Donald Trump and Bill Clinton, were originally going to be on the witness list. Now, once President Trump became president, he's no longer required to be a witness. And the lawyer for Brady Edwards, is going to represent the client here, says that Clinton and Trump will both be mentioned in the case. They won't be testifying, but their role and their connection with Epstein will be coming out.
So what are the possibilities here? When we hear there is a connection to these two presidents, to this billionaire who has faced all these accusations and admitted apparently to some of them, what's the connection? How are they going to be mentioned?
Well, in both cases, documents filed in court indicate that Trump and Clinton traveled extensively with Epstein at the very time he was allegedly abusing these underage girls. And the questions will be, what did they know? What did they see, if anything at all? And part of the issue here is the lawyer for the girls, Brad Edwards, did he act appropriately in trying to seek the testimony of the two powerful men, Trump and Clinton? He's defending himself by essentially saying, I had every reason to ask them questions about their relationship with Epstein because they traveled with him, they had phone numbers and connections with him, and that's the heart of this case.
It's going to be an interesting case because, look, this is a case filed by Jeffrey Epstein, but ultimately, it may result in testimony that makes him look bad.
Absolutely, because as part of the defense, for the first time, at least one of the underage girls will testify in public. Because of his plea deal, there was no real testimony about what happened in the case. Now some of those young women who are older will testify, and there'll be questions about what Epstein did and how his case was handled by the person who was the U.S. attorney at the time, who is now the Secretary of Labor, Alexander Acosta. He was the federal prosecutor in charge who made this sort of sweetheart deal, people are calling it. He essentially killed an FBI investigation, and Epstein pleaded guilty to two state charges only, was sentenced to 18 months in prison. And during the time he was in prison, he was allowed to leave the jail cell during the day and only essentially sleep there at night. In many cases, that kind of charge involving 40 underage girls could result in a life sentence. Epstein got off easy.
It's a tangled web. Look, we have other news to talk about tonight involving President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. He has pleaded guilty to lying to Congress. Let's talk about that quickly.
He was in court today and pleaded guilty. And the information that came out in the charging documents indicate that what he was pleading guilty about was a relationship that Trump had in Russia, attempting to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Now, Cohen had earlier said to Congress and publicly that those negotiations ended before the campaign began. In fact, today he admitted that those negotiations involving candidate Trump continued through much of the campaign. In other words, Trump had a business relationship ongoing with Russia as he was campaigning for president.
Now, that's news that a lot of people are seizing upon, but the president himself is now accusing his former personal attorney of being the one who is lying this time around.
Right. He says he's weak. He's trying to get his prison sentence reduced, which certainly is trying to get a sentence reduced. Special Counsel Robert Mueller says he believes Michael Cohen.
This will be an interesting one to follow as well. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross, I know you will stay on top of
Absolutely.
It. All right, let's move on now to another case we're following here, day three of testimony in what we're calling the case of an alleged cop cover-up. It all surrounds what happened in this video, which shows Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke shooting and killing a knife-wielding teenager named Laquan McDonald. One jury convicted Officer Van Dyke of second-degree murder, but now three other officers are on trial. The three men are accused of conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors say they lied in their official reports by claiming Laquan McDonald attacked the officer who shot him. Each one of those three officers you see there has his own defense. The state's star witness is Dora Fontaine, and she took the stand late last evening. Here she testified about what she saw when the shots rang out.
How did you know he had a knife?
He had a shiny object, and I've seen knives before.
And you say he was swaying a knife?
Yes.
And what do you mean by that?
Swaying left to right.
Okay. As he was swaying this knife, could you see him clearly?
Yes.
Right. Did you ever see him raise the knife up to his shoulder?
No.
Did you see him raise the knife above his chest?
No.
Did you see him attack anyone with the knife?
No.
Did you see him touch anyone with the knife?
No.
Did he hold the knife near or below his waist?
Yes.
As you were getting out of your car, could you still see this individual known as Laquan McDonald?
Yes.
Could you hear anything?
Drop the knife and gunshots.
All right. Besides drop the knife and gunshots, did you see anything else?
Puffs of smoke.
Where were these puffs of smoke?
They were coming from the location of Laquan.
Did you know who was saying drop the knife?
No.
Officer Fontaine told one of the defendant officers, Detective David Marsh, what she saw at the scene.
Did anyone else approach your car?
Yes.
Who?
Detective Marsh.
And would that be Detective David Marsh?
Yes.
Do you know what his role was at the time?
He was the leading detective.
How do you know that?
Because he told us. We told him, you know, we were there, and he was surprised that we had been on scene. So then he said, can I talk to you in front, and to get out of the car and talk to him in the front of the car.
And so by on scene, you mean at the location where the shooting occurred?
Yes.
And how do you know he was surprised that you were on scene?
Just his look. Like, he's like, oh, okay. Then he needed to talk to me.
All right, so you say he asked you to get out of the car?
Yes.
Did you do that?
Yes.
And where did you go?
To the front of the car.
And did he go with you?
Yes.
Anybody else?
No.
Did you have a conversation with him at the front of the car?
Yes.
And what did you say to him? What did he say?
He just asked me, what did I see?
Did you tell him what you saw?
Yes.
What did you tell him?
A male black walking southbound, swaying the knife, twisting, falling.
Next, Officer Fontaine said Detective Marsh told her what to put in an official report.
See where it says assault, aggravated, heel, knife, cut, instra?
Yes.
Do you know what that means?
Yes.
What does that mean?
An officer was assaulted with a knife.
Is that the category for this report?
Yes.
And how did the incident get categorized?
That's what I was told it was going to be.
Who told you?
Detective Marsh.
Looking further down the page, do you see where his victims are listed on the report?
Yes.
Oh, who gave you that information?
It's always the lead detective. So it would be Detective Marsh.
Did Detective Marsh give you those names?
Yes.
What are the names of the victims listed on the report?
Officer Gaffney, Officer Van Dyke, and Officer Walsh.
All right, if you'll look at the bottom of page one, where Officer Van Dyke is identified as injured by the offender. See that?
Yes.
Where did that information come from?
It had to come from Detective Marsh because I hadn't talked to Van Dyke, so I didn't even know he was hurt.
Did anyone else give you information to put in this form other than Detective March?
No.
Did you observe Laquan McDonald injuring Officer Van Dyke?
No.
Did you tell Defendant March that Laquan McDonald injured Officer Van Dyke?
No.
Our guest tonight to discuss this case is former prosecutor Lisa Wells from Atlanta, Georgia. Lisa, good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. Thank you for having me.
All right. So the news seems to really be tightening with this testimony. Do you agree?
Oh, I do. Yes. I mean, she's being told what to say when, and apparently she went along with it, even though she didn't see anything. And obviously, he's telling other folks what to say as well. And that's disturbing. I mean, you know, my question is what do they think is going to happen to them if they say what he tells them to say? And it seems like it's systemic here in the police department.
I mean, prosecutors promised that this was going to be the star witness, so certainly cross-examination was going to get really, really tough here. But from this point in the testimony, she's saying, look, I observed one thing, and what wound up in this report is the opposite of what I said I saw. That's the problem, and that's what prosecutors are really pointing at here.
Yeah, I mean, she was told what to say on the report, which was something that she didn't see. And she told him what she saw, and then he told her to say something completely different, apparently. So, it seems like the news is tightening around March completely. He was the one in charge, and that's who the buck stops with as well.
Precisely. That's the point prosecutors are trying to make here. Let's listen to this next clip, which expounds on this a little bit. Here, Officer Fontaine explains some of the words prosecutors say the defendants put in her mouth in subsequent reports.
Did you ever observe Laquan McDonald raise his arm towards Officer Van Dyke?
No.
Did you ever observe Laquan McDonald raise his arm as if attacking Van Dyke?
No.
Did you make that statement to Defendant March?
No.
Is that statement false based on what you witnessed of the shooting?
Objection, Your Honor.
That calls for a conclusion, so
yes.
That is sustained.
Didn't interrupt your objection. Did Defendant March ever give you an opportunity to review or revise this report before it was submitted?
No.
That's the answer.
That's a rule.
The evidence lawyering there trying to tighten up this particular witness's answers because they're highly damaging to the defense. Finally, this last clip from Officer Fontaine. Testimony about the dash cam video which shows the shooting of Laquan McDonald. It took Chicago police more than a year to release this recording, but Officer Fontaine says the defendant officers were looking at it almost immediately.
I spoke to Detective March.
How is it that you came to speak to Detective March?
He came and asked me to come with him.
Well, where did he ask you to go?
To an office.
What did you do while you were in the office?
They played the video.
And you say the video. What do you mean?
The Laquan McDonald walking.
Okay. Who played it?
The person who was in the room.
Okay. What do you play it on?
A computer or a laptop.
And while he played the video, what were you doing?
I was looking at it.
And what was occurring?
Detective March is like, pointed like, is this where he's walking? I'm like, yes, this is where he's walking. This is where he's turning.
Was it a question and answer or how was that? How did that
happen? Yes, questions and answers.
Who was asking questions?
Detective March.
Did Detective March ever ask you to explain what you saw using the video?
No.
More discussion now with former prosecutor and current defense attorney Lisa Wells. So, Lisa, the state promised that this officer would basically deliver their whole case. And when you hear it on direct, it does sound like, at a minimum, that one of the three defendants was trying to alter reality with the reports here. And if you extrapolate from that, it sounds like a conspiracy. I want to know, okay, why were they looking at this video so intently, immediately, and then waiting a year to release it to the public? That caused a huge backlash in Chicago.
As it should. I mean, open records request. you know, I have this issue all the time, though. Even as the attorney, sometimes I don't always get the video as quickly as I want, even though that I'm the attorney of record, because they say the case is still under investigation. So it's not always released that quickly, which I don't agree with. And then, it depends, but they knew that they had some damning evidence on it, and that's why they didn't want to release it.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've been in that position before as well, where we request something and we don't get to see it for a good long time. But look, the defense has called this witness a liar, and on cross-examination, they said she was lying to protect her $90,000 a year salary as a traffic cop, which allowed her to provide benefits for her family, own a home, and own a camp up in Michigan. What do you make of the attack?
First of all, it's irrelevant what she made or where she spent her money. The question is why are they saying she's a liar? And they haven't proven, at this point, to me, it sounds like they haven't proven what makes her a liar, why she lied. So, damaging her as a person is bad form, but that's sometimes what
they're trying to say, that she was lying to keep her job. Lisa, we'll talk again at the end of the show here. Still ahead tonight on the Daily Debrief, new legal troubles for one of the men accused in the disappearance and death of Georgia beauty queen Tara Grinstead. Plus, appeals court arguments today over the case which became the subject of the podcast Serial. Part two of the Debrief is after the break. We'll be right back. welcome back to The Debrief, folks. Additional legal trouble to report from one of the two men accused in the disappearance and death of a Georgia beauty queen. A judge has ordered Bo Dukes back to prison because he violated his parole after stealing $150,000 from the Army. Dukes served time but didn't keep up with restitution payments or ordered community service. That's why he's back behind bars. Dukes and another man are both charged with helping in the murder of Tara Grinstead in 2005. That case is proceeding. A case made famous by the podcast Serial today went before the highest court in the state of Maryland. A jury convicted Adnan Syed of the 2000 murder of his high school classmate. The case gained attention after the podcast Serial re-examined this murder back in 2014. One of the arguments before the court today was whether Syed should receive a new trial because his trial attorney didn't call an alibi witness who claimed Syed was at the library and not committing the crime. The original defense attorney, Christina Gutierrez, has since died. Today, the state argued that the law did not require Gutierrez to call the alibi witness because that witness could have conflicted with other defense theories of the case. Now, this is an appeals court argument with several references to previous U.S. Supreme Court cases, Strickland and Kimmelman.
With respect to the alibi of Ms. McClain, this case brings into sharp relief what the presumption of reasonableness means when we operate in a case where there is a silent record on whether and why Ms. Gutierrez did not contact an alibi witness. In future instances, defense counsel have to say, well, is this far enough along beforehand that I'm obligated to do this? Or can I exercise my judgment that I don't want to put him at the public library because he told me he was at the school? I don't want to put him at the public library because that could raise a risk with the general alibi by routine that I intend to present. All of those things are the kinds of judgments that I think counsel is allowed to make, even when it's easy. Strickland talks about the possibility that great lawyers will pursue a particular case in different ways. There may be seven different lines of investigation. One great lawyer will pursue five of them and ignore two. Another great lawyer will pursue a different five of them and ignore the first two. Kimmelman suggests that it would be constitutional error if an attorney didn't pursue any of them. In that case, of course, when they talked about the requirement of pursuing some investigation, this is an attorney who didn't obtain discovery because he believed that the state's obligation was to hand over discovery. That Kimmelman scenario is certainly not what we have here, Your Honor.
Appeals attorneys for Adnan Syed went second in this argument. That's because they won at the lower level. The state is the one that appealed. Here, the defense says the state has it all wrong about the record being silent.
We do not have a silent record in this case. In fact, that's the, you know, the theory that the state is presenting is because this is a silent record, counsel's strategic decisions have to be presumed reasonable. Every component of that is wrong. The record isn't silent. The decision wasn't strategic, and even if it was, it wasn't reasonable. Let me tell you what is in the record, and I can do so with reference to the case that Mr. Vidnaraja mentioned, Burt versus Titlow. That was a case involving a question about what an attorney had said to his client at a plea. What the court said in Burt versus Titlow is that this is not a case where where there was evidence that counsel failed to give material advice. Without evidence that counsel failed to give material advice, you couldn't find deficient performance in that case. So let's look at the record here. We have, in addition to the two letters from Asia McClain, identifying, of course, not just herself, but two other potential alibi witnesses and a camera in the library. We have, as was mentioned, the state's discovery response, and you can see this at Appendix 130, identifying the time of Heyman Lee's death as shortly after she left school for the day. Ms. Gutierrez got that discovery response July 10th. You heard Mr. Vidnaraja say in July, in fact, July 13th, you see defense notes in the record at pages 1255 and again at page 1257. Asia McClain saw him in the library at 3 o'clock. Asia's boyfriend saw him too. Library may have cameras.
Prosecutor, current defense attorney Lisa Wells is back with us tonight. So, Lisa, we don't often cover appeals arguments here on Law and Crime. This one was like many, though, in real life. It was heavy on case law, much more so than a criminal trial.
What they're arguing here is whether it's reasonable that the defense attorney did not contact a very important alibi witness. You know, and that's what the prosecution is trying to argue, that it was reasonable. And in other words, what they're really arguing is you know, defense attorneys have a lot of latitude in strategy. But what the prosecution is trying to do is take the defense's point of view and then say, well, she was reasonable to not contact. Well, it's one thing to not call a particular alibi witness to the stand because of the potential that something could go wrong, but to not even contact a very important alibi witness,
different situation.
Huge. And that was where she was negligent.
One other thing happening behind the scenes here, of course, is that the original trial attorney has since died. And before she died, she was accused of botching a number of other cases because of some chronic health conditions that slowly manifested and may have influenced her performance. One has to wonder if some of that was at play here. I'd love to sort of chew on that concept a little bit, Lisa, but we're just about out of time. So I want to make sure I thank you for joining us tonight here on The Debrief.
Thanks so much for having me.
And of course, we hope to see you again. Okay, so that's all the time we have for The Debrief. Our live coverage of cases from around the country is going to resume tomorrow, as it always does, at 9 a.m. And, of course, The Debrief live here on Law & Crime from 5 to 5:30. Have a good evening, and we will see you back here live tomorrow morning at 9.